Okay, see you guys.
What's the deal with my brain? Why am I so obviously insane? In a perfect situation, I head love down the drain.
I don't know if this is going to be a full Rich Outcast or just an addition to the other episode. So just in case this is a full Rich Outcast, let's start with the hello podcast, my old friend. I've come to bore you once again. This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast, and I'm your host, Algar Van Cleef. No, actually, Rish Outfield is here today. Oh, gosh, because the show comes out so sporadically, infrequently, unprofessionally, maybe that's not the word I'm looking for. How about unpredictably? Ooh. Because that can be good or bad.
Bad.
I try not to talk about what's going on in the world. There's an episode that, as of this recording, still hasn't aired, that says, Big Ankovich and I went out to dinner last night. And, I haven't seen Big Ankovich since 2017. So, it's a little outdated. But, he and I, the last episode of the Dune Steef that we recorded was just this past Monday. And he was tired. And I feel bad, you know, making him podcast when he's tired, but the guy works a lot. What are you going to do, you know? So we can really only record once he's home from work. Anyhow, he was tired. And I felt like I was unprepared. I had a little bit of material prepared, but I was mostly expecting him to say something and for me to answer it, and then we would talk about stuff. But he didn't have anything to say because it turns out he was so tired. And afterward, I was thinking about it. The next day, I was still thinking about it, and I just thought, yeah, this is not going to be one of our best episodes, but it's good to have another episode, even if it's not good. And finally I called him the next day, I think on his way to work, and I asked him, what did you think of last night's episode? And he's like, oh, I don't really remember, I was super tired. I said, yeah, okay, I don't think that it went very well. And he said, well, what are you thinking? You want us to re-record it? I was like, oh, no, I mean, we do so few episodes anyway, there's no point in re-recording it. And he's like, well, to be honest, I didn't remember anything about the story because when I tried to listen to it, I fell asleep. So I had to turn it off so as not to drive my car into pedestrians or embankments or a third thing that you might drive your car into. And then I was really tired. And so, yeah, I'm sure I wasn't very inspired or clever. I was like, oh, to be honest, what I wanted him to say was, the episode went all right. No big deal. Don't worry about it. Put it out of your mind. And so to hear him say, no, I agree, it was pretty bad, do you want to do it over again? I didn't have an answer. Instead of reassuring me, he said, yeah, we can record it again. Let's do that. And I said, well, I don't want to record it again. The episodes that we've had to record over again never feel as good the second time because they're uninspired, because it's constantly me trying to regurgitate the points and the funny stories that we told the first time. And I told him that, and he's like, oh, okay, well, you let me know what you want to do. I'd be happy to do it again if you want to. And so we're going to do it again. We were supposed to last night, but again, he was just too tired. And so we didn't end up recording last night, but we're going to do it again. And I wonder about that. Is it better? Would it be better if, like, next Monday, let's say we're going to record again next Monday, if just on that day we recorded another episode? And that way you get two episodes of our show or our shows. Maybe one of them's not so great. Maybe they're both not so great. I don't know. There's no guarantee that redoing it is going to make it better. Although, Big said he didn't remember the story, so he didn't have any comments when I was like, oh, what did you think of the story? Yeah, Uh-huh. So if he had stuff to contribute there, maybe things would be more electric. Can you just make things better? You know what I mean? Your director and your actor does his scene, and then you go, yeah, I'd like you to do it again, only better. Does that help? Can a person just do that? I don't know. Maybe I should record a coda on here after we've recorded the episode where I go, oh, golly, it was so much better. Or, we would have been fine with the original recording. Because nothing went technically wrong with that recording. We both have our haves, and, you know, I could just sit down and edit it together. I don't know. With art, a lot of times you're just guessing. You're going with your gut. I was inspired for this piece. I was not inspired for that one. Can you make yourself inspired? You know what I mean? It's one of those where it's like you have to write the most beautiful symphony of your career. And the desperation, the stakes, force you to create your best work. And everybody goes, oh my goodness, this was awesome. This was great. I can't wait to hear what you have next. And you're just like, oh. I don't know. I guess I say that a lot. I'm stuck in traffic right now. That doesn't happen a great deal, but I made the mistake of leaving during rush hour. But, you know, you're a captive audience, as always. So where we are in the real world in the time of this recording is I just finished the 5 episodes of a Sidekick's Journey that I presented on this show. And for you, that's the ancient history, and that's great. But I was listening through trying to find places to end narratively. If you can remember back that far, there were 2 segments where I ended in the middle of a chapter instead of after a chapter was done. And it was because I felt like, ooh, this is a good stopping point. Oh, this is good. It was kind of arbitrary, like I said, I said with art. I just felt like, okay, this feels like a good stopping place. And the first 2 episodes are out there, and the next 3 will drop, and it'll be interesting to see if people say anything about it, whether they like it a lot or didn't like it. I mean, hopefully they don't say, I didn't like it, because what I want is encouragement. It helps me when somebody says, hey, do you know so-and-so episode? That one I really dug. And I'll be like, oh, cool. And they say, do more like that. That's great. But when people say, you know, I didn't like so-and-so episode, that doesn't make me think I should do fewer episodes like that. It makes me think I should do fewer episodes. So there's this moment at the very end of the book where Ben is saying, I don't want to be alone again. And he cries. And I feel like that is a really solid part of the audiobook because I stirred myself up emotionally in the performance. And I actually had to stop at that point. And I laughed that I had, you know, broken down the way that I had. And I included that laughter as an outtake and somebody listened to it. And I am pretty sure they thought I was mentally ill. But the thing with emotion, the thing with sadness, is it can be tricky. You don't want to be melodramatic, is that what they said? You don't want to be hysterical. You don't want to hit people over the head, but you do want to move your audience. You do want to tug at their heartstrings. I remember Walt Disney famously gambled the future of his studio that people would pay to see a feature-length animated film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And in Hollywood at the time, a lot of people said, you know, this is doomed to fail. You're spending X number of... I think it might have had a budget of $1 million. I don't know. I ought to research. But in case it didn't, it had this huge, huge budget because, you know, of hand-drawn animation and it's a lengthy, drawn-out process. And the people were saying this is going to be the end of Walt Disney. It's Walt's folly is what they were calling this thing. And he was really nervous about whether this would sink his studio prospects or not. So they were assembling the footage, and it was rough footage, you know, with, I think at this point, still, you know, pencil sketches, and, you know, it hadn't yet been colored or painted. It was just, you know, the rough animation, and they were showing it for a bunch of Walt Disney employees, and Walt was sort of standing in the back biting his fingernails, and they got to the part where Snow White dies, and the dwarves are gathered around crying and taking their hats off and mourning, and people in the room were crying. Women were grabbing their handkerchiefs, and Walt's eyes got big, and that was the moment, at least according to myth, when he knew that this was not going to sink the studio, that this movie was going to work. Because it was rough pencil drawings at this point, but the emotion was getting through. People were touched, people were moved, people were carried away by the feeling of the film. And that's how he knew it was going to be a hit, that this was going to work. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Adolf Hitler's favorite movie of all time was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Anyhow, the Sidekick Chronicles stories, the Ben Parks ones, they tend to be sad. I like that about them. He's a bit of an underdog, and life is tough for him, which hopefully means that people root for him, that people want him to have a happy ending. And yeah, when it was just that one short story, I gave it that happy ending. And that's fine. But turning it into a series of adventures, that's going to have to be a series of minor triumphs and personal setbacks that I write over the next several years. I assume I will introduce more friendly characters, people that will be allies along the way, and I figure I'll take some of them away as the story progresses. And the one that I started writing this year and haven't worked on in months, it's just Ben and Pony, his horse. And I've considered in the back of my mind killing Pony off at some point. I'm sure it will happen. And the challenge will be to do it in a way that doesn't feel exploitive, that doesn't feel cheap. That's the word I'm looking for. You want to maximize the emotion of the moment, but you don't want it to just be, well, you only ever introduced that horse so you could kill it idea in people's minds. Well, in Sidekick's journey, Lorelei Scruggs' horse is killed. And there's this moment where I think she kneels down on the ground and he wonders what's wrong. And as he starts to approach, he sees her back sort of hitching. And he realizes she's crying over this horse. Then he stops and just gives her a moment to grieve. And I like that. I like that he witnesses this. I mean, that's a big thing with him and Lorelei, is Ben seeing things that he's not supposed to see. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, she was changing her clothes and he caught glimpses, because it's all about that, about him getting an intimate glimpse into this person, and he latches on and he wants this. He wants somebody in his life that is a friend, that is a parent, that he can trust. And that, of course, is all introduced so that I could take it away. So I am a cruel and evil bastard. But yeah, emotion is a funny thing. So Avengers Infinity War came out. And I'm recording this in that relatively narrow space of time between Avengers 3 and Avengers 4 when we don't know what's going to happen in Avengers 4. You know, a year from now, everybody knows, and all the questions that I have right now and the feelings that I have about that movie, the third movie, will be changed. Because knowing what they do in the fourth movie will affect anytime you watch it again. But right now, we don't even have a title, and so it's just anything. It's right now, it's ooh, the... And there were people whose emotions... Oh, yeah! So my sister rented Infinity War to show her boys, and I had already taken them to it in the theater. And I was way more affected than they were. But at some point, my sister texted her sister-in-law and said, I have Avengers Infinity War, do you want to borrow it? And her sister-in-law texted back saying, oh, don't let the boys watch that. I made the mistake of renting it last week, and the kids were, I think the term that she used was beside themselves. I don't know. In the back of my mind, I want to say that she said that the kids were inconsolable, but that's sort of a $1.50 word, and I just don't see that particular lady using that word. But yeah, the kids were really emotionally wrung out by it. So she didn't want my sister to show that to her kids. And I heard that and I smiled. I was like, way to go, Russo brothers. Because it's an accomplishment. It is a real achievement that a tentpole studio blockbuster film came out in the summer, ends on such a bleak note. The heroes are so utterly defeated. It's just brave. It was a risk. It was a gamble. Somebody somewhere, Kevin Feige, I guess, or whoever believes in Kevin Feige, believed in this idea enough to say, okay, we're going to do it. And I think that's great. And of course, Avengers 4 is going to have a happy ending. And so it'll undo some of that. But I heard people talking about the way that movie affected them, the surprises at the end, the characters that that movie chose to kill. And the one that everybody always talks about is Spider-Man's death. And part of it is because he's a kid and he's the only one, except for Nick Fury, who seems to know that he's about to die. But yeah, he also shows fear and he is able to be a little boy in a way that, you know, none of the other heroes that die get to be. But you know what I think it really is? I think it's that we're seeing his death through Tony Stark's eyes. Tony, who is a father figure to Peter Parker. The guy that he... Tony says in Spider-Man Homecoming, you know, that if something happens to Peter, then that's on him. Because he recruited him. He brought him into all this mess. And here he is dying. And the boy says, please, Mr. Stark, I don't want to go. I think he says, I don't feel so good. But he goes, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. And we're seeing it through Tony's eyes. And that makes it sadder. That makes it harder. In fact, you get a lot of that in the with those deaths there at the end. The first death of, well, I guess Heimdall dies first. And yeah, you see that through Thor's eyes. And then you see Loki's death through Thor's eyes. And you get that with Black Panther. Black Panther dies and we see Okoye's reaction to the death of her boss or friend or, you know, the person, her ward, the person who she's charged with protecting. Bucky dies and Captain America is just right there to see that. Groot dies and it's Rocket Raccoon looking at him when he dies. You know, even Gamora's death is shown to us through Thanos' eyes. Spoiler warning, a little late, I know. But we're seeing these characters' deaths through the eyes of people that love them, people that are emotionally affected the most by those deaths. And that is intentional. I like that. Jurassic World 2 also came out this summer, and it has a moment that is pretty emotional. I'm trying to remember it. It upset some parent that, you know, was just like, goddamn Disney doing this again, which is hilarious. You know, I mean, Disney is always the scapegoat, but I don't think they had anything to do with Jurassic World. Oh, gosh, you guys remember I did a whole episode about the pretty British girl that gets killed in Jurassic World 1 and how much outrage there was about that. And, you know, that somebody actually had the gall to say, never have they killed a female character before. Which is nonsense. All the dinosaurs are female. People complained about the death of Zara, was that her name? Something like that. In the first one. And then, yeah, people complain that there was this, I don't know, traumatic maybe? Scene in the middle of Jurassic World 2 where the island, you know, where Jurassic World is located, is it Isla Nublar? I can't remember. Is being destroyed. And there's all these dinosaurs that are dying from lava and smoke inhalation and gangland activity. And the ship is taking off that has, you know, the few dinosaurs that they managed to save on it. And our heroes, Owen and Claire, manage to get aboard this just as the ship is leaving. And as the ship is pulling away from the dock, I want to say it's a Brachiosaurus, but it could be a different kind of dinosaur. It comes up to the dock and it starts to call. It starts to bleat after them like a goat. And there's not anything that the characters can do about it. You know, they're just passengers on this ship. But this dinosaur is going to die and it's sort of, you know, calling for help. And they're just helpless to watch it. And it is a hard scene to watch. Bryce Dallas Howard does a good job of expressing, you know, the heartbreak of seeing this thing. But I wonder if the scene might have been more powerful if Owen had been the one to respond emotionally, if he had cried, because Owen was the one that thought of the dinosaurs as animals rather than as attractions or commodities or products or things. In the first movie, Owen talked to the dinosaurs, tried to communicate with the dinosaurs. He loved the dinosaurs, whereas Claire saw the dinosaurs as tools, as means to an end. And that, you know, that doesn't mean that Claire was not a good person. It's just that's sort of the roles that the script had given them. And we'll never know how that scene would have played had Owen been the one that cried and looked and wished that he could do something about this animal. But I think I would have liked it better, that moment better, had he been the one who was broken up by this sight and Claire had been the one to console him. You feel this loss, you feel the sadness because of the reaction. When E.T. died, yeah, I mean, it's just spoilers all about, guys. When E.T. died and I was a little boy, no movie had ever affected me as powerfully as E.T. did in 1982. I was a wreck in that scene when he died and Elliot is standing there and saying, "Don't go, E.T." Oh, gosh, it was a formative experience for me as a moviegoer. I had never been moved like that in a movie before. And once I became an adult, the saddest part of the movie was no longer that scene where E.T. died, because I know E.T. is going to come back, but became the part at the end of the movie where E.T. has to go away. And he echoes he echoes Elliot's words from earlier in the film when he says, "I'll be right here," and touches Elliot's heart and says, "I'll be right here." And John Williams' music swells to like unheard of levels in that moment. And it's I don't know, it works really interestingly when something like that is the case, where you're no movie had ever affected me as powerfully as E.T. did in 1982. I was a wreck in that scene when he died and Elliot is standing there and saying, "Don't go, E.T." Oh gosh, it was a formative experience for me as a moviegoer. I had never been moved like that in a movie before. And once I became an adult, the saddest part of the movie was no longer that scene where E.T. died, because I know E.T. is going to come back, but became the part at the end of the movie where E.T. has to go away. And he echoes he echoes Elliot's words from earlier in the film when he says, "I'll be right here," and touches Elliot's heart and says, "I'll be right here." And John Williams' music swells to like unheard of levels in that moment. And I don't know, it works really interestingly when something like that is the case, where you're feeling the loss through another character. Yeah, let's play the hits, kids. Transformers the movie, 1986 movie. I've heard people mock that movie for years and years, and it got bad reviews when it first came out. But it has that fairly infamous scene where Optimus Prime dies, and Prime is dead, and that sucks. That's sad. But the little boy Daniel is weeping at the foot of the big robot. And you know, that's kind of what sets me off when I think about the scene. But actually, it's weird, what I'm really thinking of is the last time I went to San Diego Comic-Con, they were going to finally release Transformers the movie on DVD in like a special edition, and they were having one of the voice actors do a signing. They were giving out these posters, and I decided to get in the line and get a poster. Not because I was a fan ever, even as a child, of this character that the voice guy did the voice of, but because, you know, I didn't have anything better to do. You make a lot of money selling these promos, and they do a lot of signings at San Diego Comic-Con for free, but they're really limited, these signings. And so that's what I got in the line for. And while I was in the line, let's say that there were 20 other people with me in line. Most of them were my age, you know, gray beards, right? Most of them were adults who had been children when that franchise was good, when the Transformers were new. And the line was about 20 people long, or 20 people ahead of me. And to keep us entertained in the line, they were playing Transformers the movie. They were playing that DVD, which was about to come out. And because it took so long for me to get up to the actor for my signature, I happened to be just standing right there in front of the monitors when that moment came, when Optimus Prime died.
"I fear the wounds are fatal."
And the guy in front of me was a big dude, about 45 years old, with a beard, and I think he had a kid with him, like a little kid with him. And the guy turned away from the TV screen.
"Prime, you can't die!"
At that moment. And this is great! This is exactly what I wanted. the emotion that I'm getting retelling the story is exactly the point I'm trying to make. I know that Optimus Prime doesn't exist. I know that the Transformers don't exist, that it was a cartoon created to sell toys, and it worked. I bought the toys mostly because of that cartoon, and yet this guy turned away, and on the television Optimus Prime says, oh gosh, what are his last words?
Do not grieve. Soon I will be one with the Matrix.
One day an Autobot shall rise from our ranks and use the power of the Matrix to light our darkest hour. Until that day, till all are one.
I can't remember what Optimus says, but his last lines are,
till all are one.
And then he turns his head, and then all the color drains from his body. And then he goes still. And they show like the heart rate monitor flatline, and the little boy starts to cry. And this guy was visibly upset by this. And it moved me to see this guy crying. A stranger, a guy I don't know. It was just a guy in the line with me. But because he had a kid, and because he was a human being, and because he loved this character, and it moved him to see this character died, I was moved as well. And when it was my turn to get the autograph signed, that was the first thing that I mentioned to this guy, is that we were... I don't remember the actor's name, I'm sorry. He was the voice of Grimlock on the old Transformers cartoon. But I mentioned, you know, we were all in the line, and... you know, there were grown men crying when Prime died. And the actor said, yeah, oh, I see that all the time. And I said, well, in 1986, when this movie came out, was there that kind of reaction? And he said, no, not that I remember, but there sure is now. Every time I talk to fans, that's what they tell me about, is how much that affected them or how much it affects them now. And I have to admit that standing in front of this actor, telling him that, I became emotional again. That, you know, 6 minutes ago, we were all crying in the line. I feel bad that I'm talking about Transformers to you, because the Transformers are a tainted franchise in my mind. Those Michael Bay movies are so, so terrible that they can't help but put a pall over all of Transform, over the word Transformers. And so I feel funny talking about it like this, like it's something important, but it was a franchise that spoke to children, and it still speaks to children, and it speaks to the child in me. I'm trying to remember the company that put out Transformers the movie. It was like DEEG or DEG Entertainment or something like that. They did not anticipate the reaction that fans would have to this movie. And they saw it as a negative, as a flaw in the movie, that children were apparently, and anecdotally we hear these stories, really upset by the death of Optimus Prime, and to a lesser extent by the deaths of all of these toys, these characters that kids had played with and loved. Having a toy of something gives you a tangible connection to it. And, you know, a girl with her favorite doll, she loves that doll, she cares for that doll, she imbues that doll with a kind of life because of her affection for it. And boys are the same way, I think, with these toys. And basically, Hasbro had introduced a bunch of new characters, or a bunch of new toys, And this movie was serving as an introduction to those characters. And so, narratively, there's like, yeah, let's kill off all of the old characters, and that way we've got new Transformers. And in many ways, that didn't work, because the new characters were not as embraced as the old characters had been. And there, so many of them are just unceremoniously killed. There are a couple of characters that we just see their dead bodies. We didn't even get a death scene for them. And that affected a lot of children. You know, I felt a little bit of that in 2017 when The Last Jedi was released. And they killed Admiral Ackbar so unceremoniously at the very beginning of the movie. I think he has a line, and then they kill him. And I understand that that doesn't mean anything to a lot of viewers of the film. It's just a character is killed. But that was the first action figure from Star Wars that I ever had, was Admiral Ackbar. I got one. It was a little while before I could get a second one, or I had enough money saved up to get another one. So I played the heck out of that first toy. So I did. I had a childhood connection to that character, a love for that character because of the toy. And I still love that character. I mean, he does something. There are a lot of characters that people love from the Star Wars franchise that don't do anything. Don't take that the wrong way. I'm not criticizing you if you love Ephant Mon or Amanaman or Hermiodal. I love Bossk. I just think Bossk is the coolest. And he does nothing in The Empire Strikes Back. He goes, oh. And that's it. That's it. Nothing. So yeah, I'm not throwing stones here. I guess I'm just trying to verbally figure out how sadness works, how emotion works, how loss works in writing, in fiction, in entertainment. There are times when it doesn't work. When they kill off a character, or they do something and they expect it to have a certain impact, and it doesn't. I remember there was an episode of Battlestar Galactica, which was a great show for a while, but it was toward the end of its run. They killed off Starbuck, who is one of the main characters. And Big Anklevich and I would watch Battlestar Galactica together in those days, and we watched it together, and instead of just being like, oh my gosh, wow, they killed off Starbuck, at the end of the episode, it was kind of like, huh, that was interesting. And I think it's because the way that they killed off her character, we just didn't buy it. We knew she would be back, or suspected she would be back. Well, if you've been a comic book reader, it's a drawback to reading comic books is, you know, unless you see a dead body, they're not dead. They got away. They're fine. Even if you see a dead body, a lot of times they got away. They're fine. You can see a character decapitated in comic books. They show up fine later. It sucks about comic books, but it's just something that you have to accept if you love that medium, because that's something that just happens. That's part of comics. They always say nobody stays dead in comic books. They used to say nobody stays dead except for Uncle Ben and Bucky. But now they just say nobody stays dead in comic books, period. And sure enough, three or four episodes later, Big and I were watching Battlestar Galactica, and who showed up? Starbuck! She's alive! And instead of, you know, this triumphant moment of, oh, wow, we thought she was dead and they tricked us. Oh, gosh. It was just like, oh. I don't know. I mean, Battlestar Galactica was a really good show. There are far, far worse shows on television that I could criticize. Don't pick on one of the good ones. But it's the example that just jumped into my head. You know, what can I do? And the answer is, by studying moments that worked, by studying things that affected me, parts that were really hard to watch, and so they stayed with me, so they made an impact, I can attempt to replicate that. I can attempt to apply that to my own work and say, okay, how did I feel when Optimus Prime died? Was it the little boy crying? You know, Ultra Magnus and RC standing by, holding each other as Optimus Prime dies. What do I have that I can bring to make it like that? The easiest advice, right, for a writer is, you know, write what entertains you. If you're a horror writer, write what scares you. Write about things that you are afraid of. If you're a comedy writer, write things that make you laugh. If it makes you laugh, then maybe it'll make other people laugh as well, and then you're a success. And, you know, for tear jerking, I guess it might be a little harder. But hand in hand, if you are emotionally involved with the characters that you are writing, with the story that you're telling, then maybe the audience will also become emotionally involved with it. I mean, that's really all I can say. They say, write what you know, right? They also say, don't try and chase fads. Don't try and knock off what is currently popular. I mean, I can echo that because I had a friend who used to always talk about, you know, I ought to write this because that's selling like crazy right now. Oh, you know what I ought to write? So-and-so kind of book, because those are big sellers and they've got to be easy to do. They're not easy to do. Anything that takes that much time demands that you care about it, that you're writing something that is important to you, that means something, that's from your heart. I mean, there are hacks out there. There are people who write for money and they don't give a crap about what they're writing. But those are already seasoned professionals. Those are people who are hired to write for others. And okay, let me finish this episode with another story of something that happened to me. I was introduced to a film producer who had a mutual friend of mine, and that friend had spoken very highly of me. And so the producer asked me, do you want to do lunch? And it's just so weird to hear that, because I'm several steps away from Hollywood now. And just the phrase do lunch is alien to me again. But when he said, you want to do lunch, I was just like, okay. And he's like, yeah, we'll go out somewhere. I've got something that I want to talk to you about. And so we went out, and I was naive enough to think, well, we're going to this restaurant. Geez, I hope it's not too expensive. How am I going to swing this? Not knowing that when you do lunch, the person is paying for your meal and your time, essentially. So this guy, let's say that his name was Joe. He said, I've been producing some very, very low budget films that we're shooting locally, and we're doing very well because they cost so little that it's easy to recoup our investment. And I have an idea for a project. I wonder if you'd be interested. And to make a long story short, I was interested, and he was going to pay me, but his idea was awful. And it wasn't even an idea like, you know, Neil Armstrong gets to the moon and discovers something else is already up there. That's an idea. What his was this movie meets this movie. Tomb Raider meets Young Frankenstein. The Love Boat meets Schindler's List. Anne of Green Gables meets Sallow, The Last Days of Sodom. I mean, I was just appalled that could be, hey, I need you to write this. There are these two properties, and I want you to rip them off in one. But it was for money, and it was a considerable amount of money, and so I thought about it, and I really, really turned it over in my head, and I came up with a take on that hackneyed premise that I could get behind. And as I was writing the synopsis for it, the treatment, you know, the not script, but just what the story would be, I became emotionally involved, and I was like, holy cow, this is really solid. Despite starting at this inauspicious place, and when I gave it to Joe, I think we're calling him, he was just like, yeah, that's great, thanks. But it wasn't what he wanted. It was too much of its own thing. He wanted Gandhi meets Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, quite literally, he wanted half of this movie and half of that movie. And the project ended up being given to another writer to make a screenplay about. And I did have a meeting with that other writer. And yeah, he liked like one or two things from my treatment. And everything else was going to go so that it could be, you know, Highlander meets Underworld. And as far as I know, that project never went anywhere. It never got made. All I know is that, you know, I didn't get to participate again in that. And the money spent just as well, whether I was emotionally involved or not. But I still think about that idea all the time. And I think about, you know, I could write that as a novel. I would really like to write that as a novel. And I've been told by people who seem to be smarter than me that I can't, that I wrote that treatment for someone else. It was work for hire and it doesn't belong to me. But there are times when I'm just like, you know what, who cares? If I want to write it, I'll write it. If I'm passionate enough about it, I will write it. And I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. Passion. Getting emotionally involved in something is good. And even though this seems to be sort of an aimless episode, and I hope it didn't waste your time completely, it's making me think. Making me think about the next Ben Parks story and how I can up the stakes emotionally. And so, hey, thank you for listening to me talk, because it went somewhere for me. I've been Rish Outfield, and you have been thanked. Good night. Is this thing on? All right. If you listen carefully, you can hear Rish in the other room. I think he's crying. Look, this show is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 no derivatives license. That's nothing to cry about, really. Okay, maybe one tear. A manly tear. But Rish really needs people to support him on Patreon. I mean, he's a pathetic barrel full of wet ramen noodles. And not the flavored kind, either. The kind you have to put that brown dust on just for it to taste like anything.
Hey, what's going on?
Fick Sean? Are you talking to the listeners?
Oh, I'm sure they've turned it off by now. You've been crying, boy.
There's this movie, The Blind Side. It's really sad.
Because the big black chap has such a tough life and learns what a real family means.
Well, no, because there's so much talk about football in it. There's a love for football in there that just breaks my heart.
And how did you feel about that part where Sandra Bullock gets it on with that huge child?
What? No, that never happens.
It's called subtext, you little lavender wildflower.
Okay.
Anyway, support Rish on Patreon. Between you and me, the television was off when I went into the room.
What'd you say?
Nothing.
The death of summer sale. My God, the death of summer makes me want to die myself.
So here's a little coda for you. I did end up getting together with Big Anklevich and re-recording that episode yesterday. And I didn't feel like it was necessary. I nearly asked him, well, do you want to do something else? We could record something else, but He had actually listened to the story this time, the production. So he felt like he had stuff to contribute. And our episode ended up being about 22 minutes shorter than the first time we did it. And I feel like it's way more efficient. We covered the same ground, but just tighter. And afterward, well, I was grateful that Big was willing to do it, that he wanted to make the show better, and he felt like it was worth the time wasted recording it again. And so by the time this episode airs, that's long in the past. It's just how Rish Outcasts work, but I figured I'd just put that little epilogue, I guess, on this episode and let you know that things worked out all right. And maybe there will be more Toonstief episodes in the future. Good night. I thought it. I was stronger. I thought I could hold out, do more than the people around me. I guess I thought I was better. I think there's a word for that. It's hubris. That's the word. I thought I was man enough to bring a Terrence Malick movie into our home and come out all right on the other side. And I guess I did. I'm here. Only cost me my family. Not too bad, I guess, considering.